This is a CBC podcast.
The marketing world is shifting from the age of persuasion to a new world order of dialogue. Terry O'Reilly will be exploring that shift in a new show, Under the Influence. Coming in January, visit cbc.ca/under the influence.
This is a pile of every catalog we have received for the last 3 months.
Okay.
I've gathered them all together, and I will now proceed to call all the companies that are sending us duplicates and tell them to stop.
That's very environmental of you.
It's getting ridiculous. We get like 8 of some of these.
You're kidding.
Check this out.
The TV show Gilmore Girls premiered on October 5th, 2000. It was based on the story of a single mother and daughter who lived in Connecticut. The tagline for the series was, "Life short, talk fast," and it was known for its fast-paced dialogue and pop culture references. The pilot episode of Gilmore Girls received financial support from the Family Friendly Programming Forum, which included some of the nation's leading advertisers, making it one of the first network shows to reach the air with such funding. Meanwhile, on another channel,
in the criminal justice system, sexually based offenses are considered especially heinous. In New York City, the dedicated detectives who investigate these vicious felonies are members of an elite squad known as the Special Victims Unit. These are their stories.
Law and Order Special Victims Unit premiered in 1999, and it followed the cases of detectives from a fictional version of the 16th Precinct in New York City. It was the first spin-off of Dick Wolf's highly awarded Law and Order series. In 2001, Gilmore Girls ranked 121st out of 158 TV shows in the ratings. Law & Order SVU was number 14. Yet, Gilmore Girls charged 75% of what Law & Order charged for its ads. In other words, they were charging almost as much. The reason? Gilmore Girls' audience was younger, even though it ranked 107 places lower than Law & Order in the ratings. But youth is the holy grail in advertising. We live in a culture of the young, for the young, and by the young. And anyone over 49 is relegated to the shoulders of the consumer highway. There is nothing so desirable as a young target market. If I were to announce in a boardroom that I had come up with a great idea to attract 55-year-old consumers, I might get laughed out of the room. But if I were to say I've come up with an interesting idea to attract 34-year-olds, everyone would lean in. That may not seem so strange to you, except for one tiny detail. People 55 plus spend more money in more categories than any other group. My name is Terry O'Reilly. Let's see what a touch of gray means to the marketing world, and why the all-out pursuit of youth trumps statistics, facts, audience size, discretionary spending power, and even logic in the age of persuasion.
Hello, ladies.
Tacos, fettuccine, linguine, martini, bikini.
Wow, what's that aftershave you're wearing?
Cough suppressant as effective as codeine, but not narcotic.
It'll keep your kids quiet for hours.
Tonight's episode brought to you by...
Fastidious librarian Emily Skinner had a place for everything, and everything had its place.
And now, Terry O'Reilly and the Age of Persuasion.
We are not afraid to get mavericky in there.
Thank you for your support.
The advertising industry has historically held a sweet spot when it comes to its most desirable target market, namely, the 18 to 49-year-old consumer. That's the age range advertisers paid dearly to reach. It's a curiously broad 31-year spectrum, and for some reason, it stopped dead at people aged 49. The history of that target group is an interesting one. Arthur C. Nielsen founded the A.C. Nielsen Company in 1923 in order to sell surveys. The company expanded its business 9 years later by creating a retail index that tracked the flow of food and drug purchases, which was the first retail measurement of its kind. It was also the first time a business could determine its share of the market. Not long after, Nielsen purchased the Audimeter, which measured radio station audiences, and created a national radio rating service in 1942. Those early ratings were very primitive, determined by which stations were listened to by a sampling of 1,000 homes. The data relied on very broad distinctions, such as the total number of regular households tuning in, and maybe, occasionally, the split of genders listening. The resulting information was sold to manufacturers and advertisers. When television arrived in the late 1940s, it revolutionized entertainment and advertising.
And now, ladies and gentlemen, introducing America's number one television star, your June bride, Mildred Searle!
Nielsen began rating television in 1950. The information was collected via a device that was attached to a television that recorded what was being watched, in conjunction with handwritten diaries sent to a sampling of families. The growth of television was extraordinary. Households with TVs went from less than 19% in 1946 to 55% in 1954 to 90% by 1962. The effect on ad agencies was equally remarkable. In 1949, for example, ad agency BBDO had 12 people in its new TV department. Just 1 year later, they had 150. The agency moved 80% of its media buys to television that same year. Its billings grew from $40 million in 1945 to $235 million in 1960, all due to television. As writer Patrick Reed said of that time, broadcast television's reliance on advertising revenues made it very different from other media, such as magazines, records, and movies. Those mediums received a percentage of operating income from subscribers or from direct purchases. But for much of its history, television has thrived by providing a broad audience to advertisers that theoretically span North America. So, in order to distinguish itself from other media, including radio, TV networks attempted to attain the largest viewing audience possible. It gave TV a unique position, as only they could boast that an advertiser's commercial could potentially be seen by tens of millions of people across the country in prime time. Maintaining that huge audience was critical to ensuring dominance over other mediums. Long before advertisers requested detailed breakdowns of television audiences, CBS was the undisputed king of the ratings. For virtually 20 years, from 1955 to 1975, CBS ruled the primetime ratings. It had a treasure trove of highly rated programs, like The Lucy Show, Gunsmoke, and the one show everyone gathered around the television to watch every Sunday.
Hello, Eddie.
Well, Topo, now you can really be happy because you have your whole family here in the country with you.
Oh, yes, Eddie. Mm-hmm.
CBS had a stranglehold on TV ratings, and NBC came second with a smaller but similar audience with shows like Bonanza. But both networks owned the older, established viewership. At the bottom of the heap was the ABC network. So, ABC chairman Leonard Goldenson decided to change the rules. What he did would impact ratings for all time. Since he couldn't compete with CBS and NBC when it came to attracting an older adult audience, Goldenson decided that ABC would create a different market that he could win. So in the 1970s, ABC decided to go after the youth market. Goldenson told advertisers that if their products were aimed at a younger target, ABC was their best buy. As cultural historian Neil Gabler points out, ABC's strategy was akin to a football team saying it had lost the game, but it had better-looking fans. Goldenson made a seductive case for his more attractive viewers, and crafted an argument that has become the defining framework for advertising for more than 40 years. He said that the younger the viewer, the more brand loyalty was up for grabs. That brand loyalty had to be won early, while the viewer was tender. And that younger consumers were more impressionable, more focused on quantity, and they bought with impatience. Conversely, ABC said that older viewers, read that to mean CBS and NBC's audiences, were set in their ways and could not be convinced to change brands or buy more of what they already had. CBS argued against every point ABC made, but the damage had been done, and ABC recalibrated to take full advantage of the sea it had just parted. For the 1969 season, ABC only had two shows in the top 20, Marcus Welby, M.D., and The Johnny Cash Show. But within a few years, ABC became a programming force with shows like Happy Days, Laverne and Shirley, and The $6 Million Man. ABC aggressively lobbied advertisers to adopt the 18 to 49-year-old viewers as the new ratings yardstick. The network also convinced Nielsen to keep a running score on a network's success or failure in attracting this newly prized segment of viewers. It became an easy sell, as youth symbolized excitement, edginess, and above all, sexiness. And what advertiser didn't want to be associated with those characteristics? Above all, younger viewers had the money and were the hungriest consumers. There was only one small problem with that logic. It wasn't true. My name is Terry O'Reilly, and you're listening to The Age of Persuasion. For years, the advertising industry focused on the key 18 to 49 target, believing that young people were most likely to develop lifelong loyalties to certain brands. The conventional wisdom being that if you bought Cheerios or Chevrolets when you were 18, you would buy them when you were 50. Except, that isn't true, is it? If you're over 55, let me ask you this. Do you use the same toothpaste you did when you were 18? Eat the same cereal? Drive the same type of car? Wear the same jeans? In fact, a Roper ASW study found that people over 50 were as likely as younger consumers to switch brands for things such as banks, airlines, computers, and even bath soap. Another report showed that when it came to other product categories, like athletic shoes, home electronics, and cell phones, older consumers were even more open to switching brands than younger ones. As a matter of fact, 78% of people between 56 and 90 are likely or very likely to try new products. But what about the fact that people aged 18 to 34 have the most discretionary spending power? There's only one small problem with that. It's not true. More than 80% of the wealth in North American financial institutions is in the hands of people over 50. Giving them 2.5 times the discretionary spending of the coveted 18 to 34 age group. They spend an estimated $2 trillion per year on products and services, and they're about to get richer. People aged 50 and older are set to inherit an estimated $14 to $20 trillion during the next 20 years. That phenomenon is boomer-specific and will not happen again. Media buyers estimate that 55% of the $20 billion spent in television primetime advertising is directed at the 18 to 49 age group. Yet, only 10% of all advertising is aimed at people 55 plus. Most of those campaigns presume there's something wrong with them that needs fixing, such as age spots, wrinkles, or erectile dysfunction. The single largest product category on television in terms of dollars spent is automobile advertising. Every car ad you see is populated with young people. Interesting choice, because young people don't buy the most cars. According to a USA Today study, consumers 50 and older spent $87 billion on cars last year, compared with $70 billion by those under 50. Even Jaguar, whose primary customer is over 50, doesn't choose 50-plus actors for their ads. While Jag used a Deep Purple music track in this commercial, the actors in it are, I'd say, about 35, max. Yet, the average age of a new car buyer is 56. They buy more new cars, spend more on the cars they buy, and buy cars for their kids and grandkids. Honda's hybrid car commercials don't show anyone over 30. Yet, as Businessweek points out, consumers over 50 buy more hybrid cars than any other group. More than half of the 90 million 50-plus consumers in North America say they want to buy green. So, why exclude people who are already in the market? For some reason, advertisers think people over 50 are invisible. Coke's Heart Truth for Women campaign is a great cause. It reminds women that heart disease is a concern beginning at age 55.
In the fashion world, good taste is anything that makes a statement. It's all about being bold, flashy, and fabulous. But sometimes the biggest statement is the one that helps make a difference. Join Diet Coke in partnership with A Heart Truth in support of women's heart health.
The spokesperson in that ad was Heidi Klum, age 36. As Businessweek asked, could they really not think of a beautiful woman in her 50s? Ever heard of Michelle Pfeiffer? By the way, according to consumer research company NPD, people 50 plus buy 60% of all carbonated beverages. Yes, there are categories where younger consumers rule, like computers and high-tech gadgets. Right? Wrong. Boomers spend more on tech than anyone. According to Forrester Research, they spent $850 on their latest home computer, $50 more than any other group. People assume Gen Y is the most eager to adopt new technology, says Consumer Insights analyst Jacqueline Anderson, but they don't have the spending power of boomers. According to another report by Forrester, 78% of boomers are online and spend more time and money there than any other demographic. Boomers spent an average of about $650 online over a three-month period last year, compared with $581 by Generation X users, age 35 to 46, and $429 by Generation Y consumers, aged 18 to 34. But how big is the 50-plus population? One in three adults is 50. Someone turns the big 5-0 every 7 seconds. Approximately 6,500 people each day celebrate their 65th birthday. If marketers only achieve success by understanding and meeting their customers' needs, and since over half the population is in the second half of their life, where is the advertising? In the 20th century, the industrialized world gained some 30 additional years of life, greater than had been attained during the preceding 5,000 years of human history. The fastest growing demographic is people aged 85 plus. As a matter of fact, if you reach 85 in relative health, chances are you might just live to be 100. The Queen used to handwrite notes to her subjects who reached 100 years old. She can't do that anymore. There are too many of them. Not only did the Hallmark card company turn 100 years old itself last year, but it sold over 85,000 happy 100th birthday cards. Here's a funny commercial from financial planning company Raymond James. It's the story of someone who plans ahead for things to come. As the commercial begins, we see an attractive lady in her early 30s on a bicycle, circa 1920.
Fastidious librarian Emily Skinner had a place for everything, and everything had its place. Each day was fueled by thorough preparation for events yet to come, whether that be next Tuesday's bridge club or the precisely organized retirement that lay ahead.
Then we see her with her new husband, then a new baby, Then, the next shot shows her blowing out the candles on her birthday cake. It says, Happy 100th.
Well, somewhere along the way, something quite extraordinary happened. Emily went right on living, longer than any person has ever lived.
We see her getting married again.
Oddly enough, she took it right in stride, because you see, she had planned for every eventuality.
Now we see her blowing out the candles on her 123rd birthday. Then we see her on yet another honeymoon. Then celebrating her 150th birthday. Then, hilariously, throwing another bouquet at another wedding.
Life well planned.
Final shot. Emily hang gliding at age 187. It's a delightful commercial, and you can watch it on our website. It's also a rare ad featuring a 50-plus actress, who in this case was actually 80. As a director of commercials, I see many actors cross the 55 mark and watch as their work slowly dries up. Great actors with enormous experience and incredible talent, but no one hires them anymore. Ageism in advertising is widespread. So, what is the problem with the advertising business? If the age-old axiom is to follow the money, why isn't advertising's famous ability to do that working? There are three possible reasons. First, the average age of a media person is 31, and the average age of an advertising agency account person is 28, and they view the world through a 30-year-old lens. In the UK, the largest number of advertising employees were under 30, with less than 20% over 40, and a meager 6% were over 50. So if the people advising advertisers where to spend their money are young, it's not surprising that companies are being convinced they should be targeting the young. It becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. Ad agency creative people are young too. Most of the people who hire my company are in their 20s or early 30s. When a demographic company recently asked a typical 30-year-old copywriter to pick a 60-year-old out of a group, he picked someone who was 75. The second reason is that marketing's lack of attention to 55-plus is cultural. Older people are portrayed in television shows and movies as loud, overbearing, boring, and in many cases, a senile punchline. Ignoring older people is tolerated. If society feels that way at large, and if advertising follows the parade, why should marketers feel any different? Third, the advertising industry has followed the youth strategy for decades and have recently shifted that demographic target a bit older now to reflect ages 25 to 54. But a lot of media thinking is that the 55-plus consumers will probably be reached with the spill of their 25 to 54 media buys. But even the word spill suggests a lack of focus and respect. So advertisers continue shutting the door at age 49 or even 54, despite the fact that the 55-plus market would probably grow revenues dramatically. Maybe New Yorker magazine said it best. In an article on ageism in advertising by James Surowiecki, he surrenders to the point that there is a demographic of genuine stick-in-the-mud types who have decided what they're after and are resistant to all arguments to the contrary. They're the ones who work in advertising. It's interesting that the word elderly entered our vocabulary in the year 1611. Yet the word ageism didn't arrive until 1969. It's ironic that the boomers were the architects of our youth-obsessed popular culture. But as the bulge passed through the python, advertisers didn't stick with them. Unlike Moses Neimer, who created Much Music in 1984, which was aimed directly at the youth market. Today, he owns Zoomer Media, aimed at the 55-plus crowd. When asked why he changed sides, he points out that he hasn't. Moses just followed his people. 25 years ago, his audience was 25. Now, they're 50 plus. Someone recently said, "Ageism is the last socially condoned bigotry." Even with $1.6 trillion in buying power, corporations remain leery of 55-plus consumers. Even though they're growing at a faster rate than younger ones, will inherit even more money and have a lot of years left to spend it. So it wasn't surprising that a survey of 45,000 50-plussers said they didn't relate to most advertising. In a world where advertisers are constantly complaining about flat or incremental revenues, it's astounding they have a blind spot for such a powerful segment of the market. It seems a touch of gray is keeping them away in the age of persuasion.
The Age of Persuasion is written by Terry O'Reilly, who has no problem with a touch of gray. He just wishes he had a touch of hair. Engineer Keith Ullman, who still wears the same jeans he wore at 18. And it ain't pretty. Title theme by Ari Posner and Ian Lefevre, the Jack Lemmon and Walter Matthau of the jingle business. Download the podcast on iTunes and follow us on Facebook and Twitter. The AOP series was created by Mike Tennant and Terry O'Reilly and is produced by Pirate Toronto and New York.
Looking for more CBC podcasts? Go to cbc.ca/podcasting.